Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll go straight into our next panel, and just a quick round of applause for Simonas. Thank you. We have three panelists. One has dropped out, which is good because the remaining three have more time to speak, and we'll have more time for questions. And we're going to focus a little bit more now on both the role, the performance, and some of the limitations, if you like, of the Central European countries' performance over the past year, specifically in dealing with presidency of the EU, the Eastern Partnership with Ukraine and Belarus in particular, but also the significance of the Visegrad Initiative in Central Europe. And maybe, Kurt, you can also add a few words about the Hungarian presidency because Matt Singer dropped out, so just a few. Anyway, let me very briefly introduce our three speakers. First of all, in order of appearance, Robert Kron, research analyst at CEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis here in Washington. Adrian Basora, he's a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and director of the Project on Democratic Transitions. And of course, very well known to everyone, Kurt Volker, senior fellow, managing director at the Center on Transatlantic Relations, SAIS, Johns Hopkins University. So we will start with Robert.
How are we working? Well, thank you, Janusz, very much. And first, let me give my thanks to the organizers for putting on this very timely conference, something we work with very extensively at SEPA, and it might not grab the same amount of headlines when you have a Eurozone crisis going on, but it's a very important issue. And so thank you very much for your efforts. Now, I've been asked to come and speak about the Polish EU presidency, and specifically within the context of the panel of opportunities taken. I think when the Poles took over the presidency, there was a very high level of expectation. I think a lot of people were hoping that the Poles would infuse some much-needed optimism and leadership and excitement about the EU at a time when there's a real crisis of confidence. So before I get into the idea of opportunity taken and look at some of the priorities and the way that they've been playing out within the presidency, I kind of want to take a second to put things into a little bit of a context or a framework to see what standing the Poles came in on and some of the good and negative factors that are either helping or inhibiting. And so to start out with the good, first we have a very pro-European population in Poland. Now, we've got upwards of about 80% of Poles which are supportive of the EU and Poland's ambitions within the EU. And this is very helpful for allowing the Polish government to act at the EU level without fear of domestic reprisals. And this is something that we saw actually during the recent elections was kind of confirmed. The second is political stability. The Tusk government has been stable, it's been secure, and that is very important for them to be able to keep focus on the presidency on the priorities without having to worry about either coalition management at home or domestic political constraints. And I think if there's any Czechs in the room, they can attest to how important that can be. Third, we have economic stability. And as we know, Poland famously was the only European state to register growth during the worst of the crisis. And now, that having been said, there's obviously issues that need to be addressed. We've got a little bit of inflation, we have unemployment, but broadly, Poland is in a good economic position. And so especially given the current economic climate in Europe, I think this is important to, one, also make let them maintain focus, but also to give them some clout in these debates. I can't imagine what a Greek EU presidency would look like at the current moment. So. And fourth, we have a good reputation and good preparation. Now, I think that it's very important to note that the Poles did a lot of extensive groundwork in making sure that they prepare administratively, that they have the capacity to chair the hundreds of thousands of meetings that go on during the presidency. They have a clear chain of command. There was a very snazzy official logo, which played off of the Solidarność logo, which I think not only is it catchy, it's also actually a very important message given where we are in the current EU climate. And there was a lot of optimism and pomp surrounding the launch, and I think that it was very important and good to see a state that is going into something like an EU presidency with a high level of excitement and bringing some of that positive energy. And along with that, just given the sort of facelift of Polish foreign policy over the last few years, I think this has also helped them a lot. This government prioritizes not only the U.S. link, which is important, but also prioritizes the EU, deepening relations with Germany, and even, you know, mild rapprochement with Russia. And this kind of multi-vectored foreign policy, I think, is what they like to see in Brussels and gives them a lot more clout as a mature actor within an EU context. I mean, to put it shortly, Poland acts like it belongs there, and I think that's important, as the first panel discussed the body language. Now, on the other hand, some inhibitors which have complicated the presidency, or at least are some limiting factors that need to be taken into account, especially if we're going to look at the idea of opportunities. And the first is, we have to remember that it's a post-Lisbon presidency. Now, I think it's very easy to overstate the power of the presidency in a post-Lisbon environment, since it's still a recently new phenomenon. But the fact of the matter is, you've got an EU president to head council summit meetings, you've got a high representative that heads the Foreign Affairs Council, and so the presidency is cast in much more of a supportive rather than leadership role. And so they pretty much have to work within the General Affairs Council and support these institutions, and there's just not the same amount of room to maneuver that there was previously with, for example, the Czech presidency. Now, a second thing that we need to kind of keep in mind... Did this go out? No, okay. Something that we should keep in mind is that this is also a fall presidency. Now, a fall presidency, given the way that the summer and winter holidays fall in Europe, really means that this presidency has about 3 months to implement its full six-month agenda. And so it can be done, but it's definitely a limiting factor, and it puts them into a bit of a time crunch and means that it's a very busy 3 months to get the things that they need to get done. And third, and probably, I guess, most important, is the ongoing Eurozone crisis. Now, this has naturally dominated Poland's time at the helm. It's eaten up the headlines, and it's more or less hijacked the attention of most of the summits that have gone on. And for good reason. It's a very important discussion, but despite Poland's leadership position, it actually has very little clout within this realm, and that's making it very harder to get others to focus on the Polish priorities when they're focused on the Eurozone crisis. So setting out this framework by which to judge, I'd like to kind of move on and look at some of the priorities or the issue areas that Poland is interested in and is focusing on. And first, a note, I think that Poland has broadly set out the right priorities. I think that not only did they specifically rate to Polish interests, but I think that they also set priorities that speak to a wider EU ambition and wider EU goals, and that's important to show that kind of leadership and not just looking to gain for yourself. And I also think it's important that they've done an excellent job marketing, and essentially, Poland has done a great job of saying these are things that we want to put on the agenda and get some movement on during our presidency, but there hasn't really been any promises of this is something we're going to finish. And that's very important and very smart because, in a sense, it actually eliminates failure. As long as these things are moving and they get these on the table, yet nobody can fault them for not having finished this, and especially given the amount of time they have to work with it and all of the crises they have to deal with, this is very important, and I think that shows a lot of maturity in how they've learned to play the EU game. Now, there's three broad issue baskets that they've got that they've named: integration as an agent of growth, secure Europe, and open Europe. So within this three basket broad breakdown, I think I'll focus on six issue areas that are not only obviously important within the Polish presidency, but also I think relate very nicely to transatlantic relations. And the first is going to be the EU and the budget and the growth agenda. Now, Poland's presidency falls on the start of the budget debates for the next multi-annual financial framework, so it was just natural that this was going to have to coincide. And even though the presidency itself is supposed to remain neutral and impartial in the debates, I think that the vision in Poland is for a robust budget that protects cohesion policies, which are very important for ongoing convergence, but is also focused towards making it a smarter budget and investing a lot more in things like research and technology and shifting money towards neighborhood policy, so that not only do you have a robust budget, but it also is a budget that allows growth, which, as was discussed earlier, I mean, if you don't have a budget, you don't have an EU, and an EU needs to have a good budget. And ultimately, I think that in many ways, this desire to push the Europe 2020 growth agenda forward has again been overshadowed by the Eurozone crisis, because it's a little bit hard to talk about growing the European market when first you're focused on trying to save it and make sure there is a European market in the first place to work with. And how Poland approaches these budget debates is, we'll have to see. Some of the institutions want growth, some states want cuts. This is, I'm sure, nothing surprising to anyone. And it'll be interesting to see how the Polish presidency can act as kind of a broker to reconcile some of the divergent positions between, say, the Czechs and the Brits, for example, or the French. And now the second one is economic governance. Now, this has become the issue of the Polish presidency, and I think that that's just happened as a matter of circumstance, given what is going on. And so this is something that they've very much had to address. Now, the big problem here is they're severely limited in actually being able to act on this portion, on this issue area, because they're not in the Eurozone. And to the extent that Warsaw could act here, I think it's done a good job. It's come out very strongly and publicly in support of integration as a way forward and solidarity and making sure that the EU sticks together as opposed to breaks apart in this crisis. And I think that's the right message to send. I think that's very important to hear. And there has been some actual tangible movement as well. I mean, it was good that the EU, under Poland's watch, adopted the six-pack legislation towards greater fiscal security and fiscal coordination. But ultimately, it's really something that Poland can't play that big a role on at this state. It would be really nice if the Polish vision of making this a pan-European solution and not just the Eurozone solution would come to materialize, but we'll have to see if that's the way it goes. Third, we have energy security. This should come as no surprise. This has been a huge priority for Poland and all of the Central European states, given the fact that their overwhelming reliance on single sources has made them some of the most vulnerable to energy disruptions. But it's also a wider European problem in terms of disruptions and just in general having a smarter energy market. Now, we had a commission report released on energy policy earlier this year and an informal energy council in Wrocław between energy ministers. And they talked about things like diversification of resources, safeguard and solidarity mechanisms in case of disasters, and things of this route. I think these are the right things to promote. I think this needs to be pushed forward. Warsaw is rightly promoting shale gas as an indigenous way to contribute to the European energy security market. I think the more we can do to move towards a more combined European energy market will be helpful. And the interconnectors, the north-south interconnectors, are going to be very important here. We've got a Polish-Czech interconnector, which is a very good start to making sure that we can link some of these grids north to south. Eventually, the ambition is to go from Poland and the Baltic states down to Croatia and the planned LNG terminal down there. And it's just very important for Poland mostly to keep this on the agenda to make sure it moves forward. Lithuania in 2013 with its presidency, I'm sure this will be a priority there. But in between, we don't have states that are largely concerned at least in the same way on this issue. And so it's important to just get momentum and make sure that we don't lose momentum on this and move forward from that. Fourth, we have common security and defense policy. Now, this is a notoriously difficult and very noble ambition on the part of the Poles, and I think they're on broadly the right track here. I mean, in the past, the idea was that Europe lacked the political will to act, but I think Libya showed us that even when you muster the political will, the capabilities just simply aren't where they need to be, and we need to move forward from this point. Poland has done a good job. It's pledged itself to a Weimar battle group in 2013 and a Visegrad battle group in 2016, and those are good starts to work within the battle group concept. And there was also a joint proposal with France and Germany on setting up an EU operational headquarters. Now, this is almost certainly going to be blocked by the British, so I don't expect a lot of movement on that. But getting this on the table, making sure that there is momentum on the issue and that High Representative Ashton has this on her desk and keeps momentum going is very important, just like with the energy security issue, because in this case, the next credible EU military state to hold the presidency won't be until the UK in 2017. And so making sure that there's movement on this, even when there's a lull in opinion there, I think is going to be very important. A more capable EU, it's better for Europe, it's better for NATO, it's better for the US, and it's better for the world. So we should move forward here. Fifth, we have enlargement and integration. This is an area where I think we've got some successes and some setbacks in recent years. Enlargement in particular is not only a core political and economic priority, but it's also a matter of principle for the Central European states, and I think this is going to be important with them. And it's also what I would consider probably the most successful EU foreign policy tool that we have, and the leverage that comes with enlargement, it was referred to as a golden carrot in the earlier panel, I think is very important to foster reform and stability on the periphery. And so the good news is that Croatia is looking set to join the Union in 2013, knock on wood, which is great. And the accession treaty should be signed within the Polish presidency. And that's very great that it happens under Poland's watch, that they can preside over this. But I think it's mostly important for two even larger reasons. And the first is, it shows that states still want to get in, that they want to get in, they're willing to work to get in, and even despite the crisis of confidence in Europe and just general enlargement fatigue that we're seeing, there's still an ambition by these states to go in. And second, that Europe still has an open door, that Europe is still expanding and that they have the option. And I think this is an important message to send, especially given the enlargement fatigue, if we want to keep other states on track in the Balkans, for example, Serbia, and make sure that they keep moving towards this goal and maybe eventually also within the Eastern vector. But as far as the integration, I think we've seen a really negative setback in the veto of the Romanian and Bulgarian Schengen accession bid. Now, one can understand the reservations that the Dutch and the Finns have over crime and corruption. I mean, this is a legitimate concern and one the presidency is addressing by also focusing on, for example, border patrolling. But I think that it's become politicized. I think that it sends the wrong message. And there's not much the presidency can do against a veto. But this is just a bad message to send. They fulfill the technical criteria. A lot of Europe's power and leverage comes from the fact that it is at least nominally impartial and bureaucratic set of objectives that need to be reached. And so the message for solidarity here is not very good, and I hope that this moves in a different direction soon. And the sixth, which is really kind of 2 points, is neighborhood policy. And now this is kind of the cherry on top, and this falls into two categories, the South and the East. And there's a definite distinction there because the East are essentially states that at least in theory have the prospect of one day acceding to the EU, whereas the South, you do not have this perspective, so they need to be treated a little bit differently. And so to start with the Southern vector, I think that progress here has been broadly positive, if a little belated. We have the renewed European neighborhood policy, which pledges a little more money and is a little bit more focused. It introduces the more for more principle, which I think is good, and I'll get to in a second. And it also at least put on paper the idea of the Polish championed European Endowment for Democracy, which is broadly structured, at least in theory, on the American NED. But what Poland can do further here is that these things need a lot of clarification. When it comes to the more for more principle, it's a question of what are the metrics, what are the benchmarks? Are these going to be for individual countries, or is this going to be a broad set of metrics that they have to reach? And the more clarity we can get here, the better to move this in a good direction and make sure we succeed. And on the EED, the European Endowment for Democracy, it's not part of the MMF, the Multiannual Financial Framework, so there's a little bit of question on where does this fit. And where Poland can really play a role here is also to bring some clarity to this. Where does this fit within the context of other EU already existing organs for this kind of work, like the EU instrument or European Instrument for Democracy and Human Rights? Will this be a union project, a standalone project? Will this be something that's a little bit in between? And so, who's going to fund this? I mean, these are all questions that need to be answered. I think Poland can really do a part in putting some concrete proposals on the table, maybe starting this as a regional vehicle and moving that forward so that others can buy into that. And it's important that they act in the Southern neighborhood because Poland and its neighbors, for that matter, they don't have a lot of the historical baggage that we see with a lot of the Western European states in the region. There wasn't a colonial past. There wasn't some overt ties to the fallen dictators. And there was just a recent experience with transition. And so I think that if Poland takes leadership here, they could have real clout that the Western Europeans might not even be able to match, because I'll think they'll be willing to listen. And then the second part of that is the Eastern Partnership. And this has been Poland's most important issue for a long time, and for that matter, brainchild. But I would be lying if I said that developments here were entirely positive. I think the good is that Poland convened the summit. It was smooth, it was successful, it was well managed in an administrative sense. It's good that it's being kept on the agenda, that we're keeping Germany involved and interested, and we're at least not losing momentum. But what we can really see here is a little bit of more of the same as opposed to any forward movement, in my estimation. Many leaders didn't even attend. They sent deputies. The language changed from calling them European countries to acknowledging their European aspirations. And so the messaging there is a little bit suspect. And the countries themselves leave a lot to be desired. And I won't camp out of this too much because I know it'll be addressed. But, I mean, Belarus is a very specific basket case in and of itself right now, and yet they were still offered this $9 billion payoff, and it's questionable to see where they're trying to go with this. Ukraine is on a knife's edge, and especially after the Tymoshenko trials, we don't really know what's going to happen to the free trade area. Some people are saying as much as sanctions. Others are saying we just need to go ahead, and so we really need to see what's going to happen there. Moldova, Georgia are locked in frozen conflicts. There's really nothing they can do in an immediate term to put themselves on an enlargement perspective, and the rest of the countries, they're kind of reminding me of the D.C. Metro. I mean, more money keeps going in, but the escalators still don't work. So I think that if we're going to move this forward, it's good to keep it on the agenda. It's important for the U.S., it's important for the EU, but there needs to be a lot of soul-searching to see where we can bring this forward. And so to bring this back into the original structure of our context, how can we rate this? And I think if we judge based on fair expectations, thinking about the limitations that were set out, I'd say Warsaw has actually done an excellent job. I think they've knocked it out of the park. I think they focus on the right priorities. I think that disconnected from tangible outputs and just the court of opinion, I think that everyone I've talked to has been thrilled with the amount of energy and excitement and pro-European energy that they have brought to this. And in three words, I guess they've shown confidence, competence, and comfort within the EU. And this is good for two reasons. One, because it's a form of reassurance for Poland itself to keep doing what it's doing, essentially, and to grow. And second, because it shows the world that after lukewarm responses to the Czech and Hungarian presidencies, that a Central European can conduct a mature and stable presidency without government collapses or infighting with the institutions or domestic political troubles. And so I think this sets a great template for further presidencies, and I think Warsaw has done a great job as administrator-in-chief. And I think that's my cue that my time is up, so I will end there. Well, if it means slit my throat, then I think I should go, but... But in any case, thank you. I look forward to questions, and I'll turn it over.
Okay. Can you switch
off? Yes. Okay, thanks, Robert. Take a deep breath. That was a lot of territory you covered there.
And I had more, so...
Yeah, I know, but maybe we'll extend it next time. Adrian Visegrad.
Now, I could give you 20 minutes or 30 minutes of very thorough discussion of the Visegrad 4, its history, its future, and how it fits in with everything we've been discussing. And I will not start that way, and nor will I try to be complete about it, because, as several people have said, context is what matters, and history matters. And we have discussed so much, such a large amount of the context and the structure within which the Visegrad 4 operates, as so eloquently explained now in the Polish presidency by Robert Krohn, that I would like to make a couple of comments about the context and then just give you briefly, within that context, how I think the Visegrad 4 and the enlarged Visegrad, the Central European collaboration or cooperation, might work to the benefit. Let me start by telling you where I stand with regard to the optimism versus pessimism kind of discussion that we heard in the first panel. I would dare to call myself an optimist, but Simon Serfati defined it better, and that is, in the face of a crisis, being a constructive pessimist, a creative pessimist, who tries to do the necessary while admitting that there's a crisis to deal with. That's the stance that I take. I strongly agree with Simon and some of the other speakers who have said, and unfortunately Steve is not here to defend himself, strongly disagree with Steve Larrabee and others who have in effect implied that NATO is moribund or going backwards and the EU is stagnant and perhaps falling apart. Both have think of a boa constrictor having swallowed a huge pig that is larger in body weight, or almost as large in body weight, as the snake itself. This is what EU enlargement, the new 10 members, just within the last few years, has meant. It's not surprising that it's taken them a while to get their governance structures, if you add a financial crisis, world financial crisis to that. Not surprising at all. I still strongly agree with Simon Serfati that they are absorbing, they are digesting, and it will, haltingly and slowly, but it will go forward, the European project. The same with NATO. Afghanistan is something that NATO swallowed. Some of the NATO members have helped in Iraq as well. This is, and the United States itself has been absorbing and trying to digest these two huge undertakings, with some helped by and encouraged to some extent by less than desired but still important contributions from several NATO members. And I would underline some of the former communist or Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern European members. Very, very important psychologically and politically. It is, as Steve Larrabee himself said, a good thing that NATO has decided not to expand in any foreseeable future towards Ukraine or Georgia. The last thing that you need when you're suffering a long period of prolonged digestion is to take on another large set of problems to digest. Libya, an important success, getting back to the idea that this is an alliance where we both have, both sides of the Atlantic have obligations. And I think that ultimately the Poles and other Eastern Europeans will help when it comes time to build democracy in Libya as well as elsewhere in the Arab uprising countries. So that's the context. And EU expansion, as we just heard from Robert, EU expansion is going forward. Not only are the 10 countries that have recently joined being gradually absorbed and some of them observing with distinction in European leadership, EU and OSCE. But in addition to that, Croatia is well on its way. Montenegro, we just heard, is now going to be a candidate, and the Serbians are coming along. There will be future expansion to the Balkans, slowly but surely. It's important that it not be too fast, and this takes us right back to Central and Eastern Europe. Romania and Bulgaria were admitted too soon, before the problems of corruption, before the problems of effective governance were sufficiently vetted while the EU had its maximum leverage before accession. They should not make that mistake, and the U.S. shouldn't encourage them to go prematurely. In the case of the former, there are many of the similar problems that you have in Romania and Bulgaria in the former Yugoslav countries. But they are moving ahead, and they are using their leverage, and it will be a success story. Now, let me turn to the specific subject of the Visegrad 4, but also the expanded Visegrad 4, which at some level of expansion means all of the former Eastern European countries, the former communist countries that have now joined the EU. Should it be taken seriously? Can it make a difference? Of course, if you take it on the global scale that so much of America's attention will be focused on the Middle East and Pacific, in the Pacific region, and China and India, et cetera. It's a small, relatively small. The contribution that the Visegrad 4 can make is relatively small. But that is not the scale on which foreign policy is made. That is not the scale on which institutions are built. That is not the way the real world works. It works in increments. I think that the Visegrad 4 has potential. It was created 20 years ago. It's had down periods when it was less relevant or less united. With the Georgian War and other causes of apprehension, like the seeming neglect or the so-called benign neglect in the early years of the Obama administration, more incentive for the Visegrad 4 to come together to resume their common agenda of making sure that the United States, I'm talking about the Visegrad 4 dialogue with the United States as well as their role within the EU. But just keeping to the United States for a moment, Poland is very influential. Poland plus the three Visegrad 4 countries is considerably more influential. Poland, when it can speak in some cases, or when other spokesmen for the Visegrad 4 or the Baltic 5, et cetera, can speak knowing that they're speaking for all of the former communist countries of Europe, that makes a difference. It makes a difference in Washington. It also makes a difference in Paris and in Berlin and in London. So this is the fact that the Visegrad 4 countries have come back together, have initiated a regularized dialogue with the United States, meet regularly and prepare certain agendas for EU meeting in Brussels or elsewhere during the the many different EU fora. This is very important. It's important to the point where Nicolas Sarkozy noticed that the Visegrad Four were getting together in advance of meetings and said, oh, they shouldn't do this. Why? Well, because when they come to a Council of Ministers meeting, the Visegrad Four countries have more votes or as many votes as Germany and France together. Now, clearly, they don't have as much influence. But acting together, they have a lot more influence than they would have alone. Very simple point. Now, very quickly, how much time do I have left?
You finished. No, I'm joking. You have about 7 minutes maximum, though. Absolutely.
Maximum. All right, okay. Yeah. That'll be very easy to meet, then. Here are the tests that I set myself in an article that I did in conjunction, encouraged by Kurt Volker and people at and people at SEPA and also the Atlantic Council. The test of whether the Visegrad Four can make a difference are the following. First, can the CEE, can the Visegrad Four countries or the Central European countries as a whole gain significantly more by working together than working apart? The answer is obviously yes. From the Washington point of view, is the potential benefit enough so that the overburdened assistant secretaries and undersecretaries of state and defense, et cetera, will spare the time? Well, so far, they have said yes, and they've engaged, and from what I understand, are finding it valuable. But this is a big question. The diversion of U.S. attention and resources is an important issue that is on the table here, and we should discuss in the Q&A. So my answer is, yes, maybe the Visegrad Four can be viewed from Washington as an important grouping that can help advance the American agenda and the global agenda that we cooperatively seek with Europe. Third question, could the V4 countries, by acting together, become a more important factor within the EU? Well, I think the answer to that is yes, if they choose their issues carefully and they choose them in such a way that they're not in conflict with Berlin or with Paris, for example, Libya, in the case of Poland. And there are many such issues, like the Eastern Partnership or now perhaps the Mediterranean, et cetera. Fourth question. So the answer is, yes, the V4 can make a difference in Europe if they stay united and build on the precedents that they've already started to build. The fourth question, do the V4 have sufficiently compelling common interests to stay together for a long enough period to institutionalize and get people used to the fact that they have an important grouping within the EU and within the Transatlantic Partnership to deal with, and that grouping should be taken seriously? Well, the question, that is, my answer to that is a maybe. I won't be overly optimistic in the sense that there are different changes of government. We just saw the Radičová government fall in Slovakia on an important EU matter, for example. So the answer is maybe. But if the U.S., if Washington, and if Brussels do take seriously the Visegrad Four and do work, and the V4 use this, and the V4 plus, very importantly, to enhance their leverage and to enhance certain agendas of common interest with the United States and that are positive for the majority of the EU countries, then the electorates within Slovakia and Hungary and Czech Republic and Poland, which is already the most converted, by far the most converted to this agenda, they will elect people or not listen to demagogues who will argue in the opposite direction. So, in sum, I think the Visegrad Four is an important development or reincarnation. We should take it seriously. Very importantly, not only should governments take it seriously, but think tanks and fora and the private sector should take it very seriously. And we can talk about what was at one point conceived as a Washington Central European initiative to bring the NGO sector and other elements of the private sector together to talk about to do something to enhance and continue to encourage and lobby for continuing U.S. engagement, both in the executive branch, also on Capitol Hill, where it's a harder sell. But I think my answer is the V4 has done a good job. They're off to a good start in making themselves count more than they could individually, and we should encourage them. Thank you.
Wow, that's very disciplined. You have one more minute, but never mind. No. Thanks very much. Great job. Kurt, Ukraine and Belarus, the Eastern Dimension, and a little bit of Hungary if you want to. It's optional.
If it's all right, I think I'd also like to just comment a little bit on context as well, too. because I think to start talking about these things, the first starting point is that the transatlantic relationship is under a lot of stress right now as it is. And it has very little to do with Central and Eastern Europe. It's driven by the economy, financial crisis, debt, deficits, political incapacity on both sides of the Atlantic. And so that is what's straining the transatlantic relationship. And I think, you know, it's probably hard to imagine a worse time to be the president of the EU if you're a Central European country, because the issues that everyone is anguishing over and trying to deal with are ones that you have relatively little influence over. Not even in the Eurozone, for example, and yet the Euro is the big issue that people have to grapple with. So that's the first thing. And you know, to Adrian's observation about the boa constrictor, the anaconda swallowing the pig, I think, on the one hand, I totally agree. I think that the absorption of Central and Eastern Europe into the EU and NATO has gone rather surprisingly smoothly. I mean, if you think of all things that might have gone wrong, none of it did. But on the other hand, that's not the problem. The problem with the EU and the problem with NATO is something else. Now, against that, the Central and East European presidencies, I think, when you look at the track record over a year of Hungarian and Polish leadership now, I think it's a mixed review, but basically a positive review. And I think, as Robert indicated, but I think if you look incrementally, there have been some positive developments or steps that have taken place that have moved the ball forward in ways that are useful. There is more. Europe is closer to having an energy security strategy now than it was a year ago. They have done some specific things, like some of the interconnectors. The recent decision to look at Gazprom's, you know, market activities, you know, does it conform to EU standards or not? That's a positive thing. I think the EU is closer to having a more unified policy toward Russia than it was a year ago. Still not quite there yet, but closer. I think that the Eastern Partnership has more focus than it did a year ago. So you can look at all of these things and the enlargement issues, you know, with Croatia having plodded forward and the decision now on Montenegro. So all of those things have moved forward. Now, that said, I'd also add that, you know, I would put the opposite spin on it than Robert did. Domestic developments in Central and Eastern Europe have been challenging, especially at a time of economic downturn. But they have not affected the leadership of Central and Eastern Europe in running the EU machinery the way they've needed to. That has gone very smoothly. And I think you even have to give Hungary some credit that despite some financial numbers that are worrying, it's not Greece. It has credibly been able to manage where it is so that it has not gone down the same road as some others. So that is sort of a snapshot there. Now, when you look at Ukraine and Belarus in particular, let me take one step back from that. So I think that you still have a situation where Central and East Europe is maybe punching below its weight in the EU and in NATO and other things. Maybe that's partly because of financial and economic capacity, partly because of history, partly because of military capacity. But it could be a more of an agenda setter within the EU than it has been. And that being said, I think one of the reasons why it isn't is because you do have some conflicting impulses within Central and Eastern Europe. Adrian just talked about the Visegrad, and I was thinking, well, how would I sum that up? I would sum it up by saying that the Visegrad countries themselves find the Visegrad cooperation useful up to a point. And so that's pretty much the way everybody else treats it. It's useful up to a point. And that's, you know, it could be better. And I agree with you. We should encourage more. But it's still not quite there. The issues on the Eastern Partnership, I think, come down to one fundamental question. Is it better to emphasize engagement and in doing so hope that you can advance reform and change and work with the populations of a country and create incentives for the governments to modernize, reform, become more European? Or do you have to use sticks instead of carrots and say you need to put sanctions on something like the Lukashenko regime? You need to respond when Ukraine throws Tymoshenko in jail and leaves her there. And I don't think that there's a coherent view in Europe even about how to handle this. Last year, the trend in Belarus, for example, was toward engagement for a while. Both Lithuania and Poland were heading that direction. And then getting through the election, Lukashenko beats up all the opponents and throws them in jail. And then I think people concluded, well, engagement didn't work very well. So now we have to go back toward sanction. I think we're crossing that threshold again with Ukraine, where efforts to take Yanukovych at face value and saying he wanted to come closer to Europe, it's not actually what he's doing. And I think there is now more pressure to respond with more sanctions or more toughness toward Ukraine. But getting that kind of right policy toward Ukraine and Belarus is very, very hard and is something where I think Central Europe still has some of its own sorting out to do. It's got some regional, local, national, historical interests that are conflicted with some of these, with both of these countries, and therefore it hasn't been able to help shape a broader, again, consistent EU and transatlantic approach to these two countries. But that is ultimately where it needs to go. And I guess I would come down on the side of if you engage the regimes the way they are, you remove incentives for them to change. And so I think it does require more of the tough approach on both of them, as we have begun to see lately. And I hope that that solidifies as both a Central European view and then also the way that they're able to shape the direction in which the EU deals with this. So it is an Eastern partnership with a bit more toughness in it rather than just the engagement side, which should continue where it is fruitful. So I'll pause there and then hope to take part in the Q&A.
Great. Fantastic. You were the shortest speaker, actually, Kurt. If you were here for the first panel, I thought we'd go on forever. But anyway, we have plenty of time for questions now. In fact, let me pose the first question to you, Robert. We had a question earlier this morning about populism. I think it was Ambassador Russell mentioned it. Not much was said about Central East European populism. And it's gone through several phases, I think, in different parts of the region. Poland, for example, has had its Tymińskis early on. It had its Party X, had its Lepers and companies. And now it has somebody called Palikot. Can you sort of give us a feel of the Palikot movement, which did very well in the first elections that he actually stood in, over 10%, and I think 23% of the 18 to 25 age group actually voted for him. Can you tell us a little bit, because this is sort of liberal populism, it's not a nationalist populism, it's not a utopian populism, like Tymiński I would describe. Where does it fit in Polish politics, and where will it lead Polish politics, if anywhere, do you think, over the next few years?
Oh, well, the Palikot movement. Well, I think the interesting part about the Palikot movement, which is just kind of an interesting overview of the Polish political scene in general, is that, you know, Poland doesn't really have a right-left or a strong right-left kind of tug in their political scene. And the left is very weak, and after this election, even weaker. And so what you really see is a you know, how far from the center are you going to go? And for that reason, where you've got, you know, you've got PO closer to the center and you've got PiS more to the right or different views on it anyway. And in this case, the Palikot movement is very interesting in that it is broadly centrist in some senses because it is an offshoot of PO in some senses, but it's also bringing something new, which is this kind of anti-clerical liberalism that we're not seeing, and that usually has been the thread that's kind of united the right to varying degrees. And so this is going to give a whole new dimension and a whole new voice to the Polish political scene, and it almost is a replacement for the left as kind of an opposition on some of these social issues. And so where that will develop, it's hard to say. I mean, the movement did very well. I mean, in some ways, it probably stole away PO votes that could have given them an even more solid majority in the same. But I think that on most issues, Palikot will work well with the government that's going to be in place. And I think that I don't know. It's hard to say. It's a it's got some parallels to the public affairs situation in the Czech Republic, where it was a mix of protest vote, a mix of something different, and there was a lot of different factors that led to the success there. And just like with the public affairs in the Czech Republic, you're seeing that, I mean, this is a new party, it's untested, we don't really know what it's going to do, and so we kind of have to wait and see how that will develop.
Sure. Watch this space, let's see what happens. Okay, questions? Go. Suddenly all the hands went up. Please. We'll take a few, if you could be very brief, and then we'll go to the panelists. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Gergely Varga from SAIS Center for Transatlantic Relations, visiting fellow from Hungary. I'd like to ask that with the uncertainties in European integration and with less US attention within NATO to Central and Eastern Europe, do you foresee a much more broad security and defense policy cooperation between Visegrad countries within the next few years? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Julian Josephson with Bootstrap Press and tries to be a practitioner of cheerful pessimism. I want to address, if I may, to Mr. Krohn and to Mr. Satunas. You're addressing trying to wean Poland and I guess the Visegrad countries, Lithuania too, I would assume, from this single or source dependency or near single source dependency on for oil and gas, and looking for more internal sources. Well, how can this be done? And how do you see doing it in an economically viable manner when you also have to meet rather considerable, not only meet rather considerable European Union environmental regulations, but also overcome some of the environmental sins that took place when you all were under the Soviet bloc?
Work simultaneously. Simonas has a question, but don't answer your own question afterwards. You answer his question. You see what I mean? Because we're taking three at a time.
So Adrian, my question is, you were talking a lot about this regional cooperation or talks. So can you elaborate or do you see where we can in depth go with the Visegrad Four and Nordic Baltics? I mean, where you see a very natural and strong connection.
Hold your answers a second. Energy and then we'll go to the others.
Oh, about energy. Yes, it's topic number one in Lithuania. And talking about commercial availability of the projects that we do, we are building LNG terminal. We are creating Baltic electricity market. We are building a nuclear power plant. So the answer is that when you look at the prices, what we are paying now, all other options are commercially viable and attractive. But it's not going to be easy. We want to create a real market. Our principles are very clear, to create an energy market in the region, in the Baltic states. When you are 100% dependent, so you cannot be, there is no market. So.
Well, I'll start with the specific one that was addressed to me, and maybe make one or two comments if you would like on the others. To Simonas, if I understood your question, it is on what issues can or should the Visegrad Four cooperate and have credibility in their dialogue with the United States, at least partly with the United States and within the EU, obviously. Their leverage is a lot stronger worldwide if they are speaking for, at least in concord with the rest of the EU. Well, the political directors who came here last December had the following agenda, which I thought was very realistic and very focused. The V4 political directors engaged with their counterparts here in Washington. Their agenda was Afghanistan, Turkey, energy security for all of Europe, potential EU-US cooperation regarding the Eastern Partnership, and integration of the Western Balkans into NATO and the EU. So they're all subjects of strong interest to the V4 countries, and of interest to the United States, where our interests coincide. And again, acting in unity, there is greater strength. Let me take the occasion to comment. I agree with Kurt, obviously, that the full potential of the Visegrad 4 or the V4 plus when they unite with the Baltic countries or when they consult with Romania and Bulgaria and or Slovenia, their voice is even more powerful. They have a long way to go. But just think back very, very few years ago. Do you remember what Jacques Chirac said about Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europeans? They missed a great opportunity to shut up. In other words, they were to be seen but not heard. That was the attitude of the French president. Now they are seen and heard and treated with respect on an increasing range of issues. If they build on that precedent slowly and surely, they will be more and more effective. And choosing the right issues is the best way to do that.
I'd like to address the energy issues a little bit more because Simon's kind of did it in shorthand. And so let me... But the when you talk about the economic viability, you have to compare it against what's the economic cost of doing things the way you do them now. So it may be expensive to build an LNG terminal. It may be expensive to build the interconnectors. It may be expensive to put one in Croatia. But if you don't do it, then you are in the situation of dependency where prices can be set artificially and remain quite high. So while you put the money into it and then prices come down, it may have been an expensive investment, but it's against what you would have had otherwise rather than just making the choice to make the investment or not. And in terms of the opportunities, I think there are quite a few opportunities, and they are being developed and emerging quite well. It is the LNG terminals. It is the interconnectors so that you're connected to a West European energy grid as well, so that you have tremendously greater diversity of supply coming in if you're connected to the West European grid. And then it's also the exploitation of unconventional energy resources in Central and Eastern Europe, particularly the shale gas. And then it's also the continued development of nuclear energy, which, though it's had a setback in the last year, I think is still going to remain on the table as an important source of electricity for all of Europe, and particularly Central and Eastern Europe. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and the costs of doing it are affordable when compared with the costs of not doing it.
Well, honestly, I don't have much to add to that. I think that's entirely spot on. I mean, I think in terms of opportunity, I mean, thinking creatively and not ruling things out immediately, and I mean, really trying to push this forward. But the things that were mentioned, I mean, the shale gas, I think, can be really great. I think that Czech nuclear efforts with the Temelín plant can play a role in this, especially since there's some, at least, you know, verbal cooperation now between the French and the Czechs on this, that maybe this can get a wider perspective, and finding ways to link this and just taking incremental steps but going there. And I agree that, you know, it might be expensive, but the costs of not doing so are even higher. And so it needs to move forward. I don't have much more to add on that. The other question, which I understood as, with all the uncertainties, what is kind of the broad security and defense coordination prospects within Central Europe? I like that. It's a theme song. Yeah. Should I start singing? Well, I think, I mean, it's tough to say here. I think that there's been some positive signs that this is possible. I mentioned the Visegrad battle group, and I mean, I think that that's at least a good step. There was talks of much more deep cooperation between the Czechs and the Slovaks as maybe kind of a starting point and linking into this a little bit more broadly, which we'll have to see how that ends up if we end up with a Fico government in Slovakia. We'll see if that strains politically some of those efforts. But, I mean, I think that the environment is there. I think that it is something that would be good and that could move forward, and it could be a kind of a regional building block which could then tie into a wider EU effort. But it's going to need a lot of political will. So we're going to see if the leaders are willing to take that step.
Okay, next questions. I see you at the back there, please.
My name is Sergim, and I come from Macedonia. And I have a question for Mr. Robert. The question will be enlargement policy of EU. And as you know, Macedonia has a great obstacle towards NATO and EU integration, and the name is Greece. Over the name issue. And do you think that the Europe was, or EU was not sincere with Macedonia with the dispute with the name issue, as was with the issue of the Piranian Bay with Croatia and Slovenia.
Okay. Bill, you wanted, right?
Bill Siefkin here with CSIS. I'd like to take advantage of the presence of the experts on the panel here to see if I can get them to engage in a little speculation concerning two situations which I think will have significant impact on the Central European region. One is what I would consider to be sort of the evolving role of Germany vis-a-vis the European Union and its neighbors, and particularly in the context of the euro crisis. And secondly, the potential return of President Putin in Russia, as well as the whole German-Russian relationship. So I'd be interested in your thoughts.
I mentioned that at the outset. Nobody took that up, but I'm glad you revisited that. Please.
Hi, my name is Richard Owens. I'm with the National Intelligence University, and I'd like to present kind of a two-part question to all three of the panelists, if I may. And the first one is the Visegrad, formation of a Visegrad battle group. How much of that do you think is a direct lack of confidence in NATO going forward? And lastly, how popular is the Visegrad from a public perception in each of the four different countries?
I think we'll limit ourselves to those three. Do you want to start with the Macedonian question, Robert?
Macedonia, the question was, if I understand it, the sincerity of the EU going into the Macedonia question. And I think, I don't think that we should question whether the EU actually legitimately had, you know, an integrity approach. I think that the EU wants to see Macedonia in. I think that the EU wants to see broader enlargement. And I think that despite the obstacle that is going on right now, I mean, it's still a much different situation than a Turkey, for example, where I think the political situation is so divided that it's a little bit of a different category. And I'm sorry, I must say that if I had a silver bullet answer to how to get past this crisis, I think I'd be getting a lot more phone calls, so I don't really have that. But I don't think that we should doubt EU integrity.
Kurt, Germany, Russia, Putin?
Well, it's an interesting question because I view both of those as constants. So that there isn't anything new that we're seeing with Putin becoming president again. He's been running the country for the last 10 years already. And with Germany, you know, it's a change. You know, if you mark the change from Kohl to Schroeder, that's when Germany started to play a different role. And I don't see that. You know, while Merkel has had a different style, I don't see that, you know, the things that Schroeder unleashed fundamentally changing. And what would that be? Under Kohl, I would describe German policy as being pretty balanced three pillars, pro-transatlantic relationship, pro-Europe, and engaging with Russia, but in balance with those things. And starting with Schroeder, basically a diminished importance of the transatlantic relationship, including even running against U.S. policy as part of the 2004 election. 2002 election. And much more ambivalence toward Europe, where, yes, we want Europe to work, but we don't want to pay for it. So that leaves a greater emphasis on the relationship with Russia as the thing that has become more and more visible as part of Germany's policies. Central and Eastern Europe, I think, have positioned themselves in response to this. While it wouldn't be where they would have started off 5 or 6 years ago, say, what would we like Germany's policy to be in our relationship with Germany? I think that most of Central and Eastern Europe now has basically, you know, the way I would put it is, we're not going to be out-reset. If the U.S. is resetting with Russia and Germany is in this relationship with Russia, we're not going to be in the odd box here. We're going to have to get along. And so aligning themselves to the extent possible in a close economic and political relationship with Germany, and in that way being part of the EU mainstream rather than being outliers. And I don't really see that changing either, even though there is, you know, you scratch the surface, as you know, everyone's worried about Germany and everyone's worried about Putin. The choices that people have made, I think, are going to stay pretty much the same that we've seen for the last few years.
Adrian, Visegrad.
So on Visegrad, I won't give you the whole discourse, and I can send. We can give you, if you give me my card, your card later, I'll send you a fuller piece that I've done on it. And I know that Robert and lots of other people here can also give you a lot more background. It was formed in 1991, long before NATO membership was even a prospect, or at least a promised and an offered path of joining, by Václav Havel, Lech Wałęsa, and Josef Antal of Hungary. The idea being to seek dialogue in common with the West, but also to band together and encourage their own internal reforms and make themselves a little bit stronger against the fear of a Russian return. It has had its ups and downs once they joined both NATO, once these countries joined both NATO and the EU, and also when Slovakia split off and Mečiar pursued an Eastern policy, not interested in joining the West. It went through a down period. Then it returned when the Christian Democrat, the coalition came in Slovakia in 1998, and all the more so with greater strength after the Soviet, the Russian invasion of Georgia. There was alarm. So that's one reason why it's become so crystallized or organized. Now, I do want to relate this to both Putin, the return of Putin, and the evolving role of Germany. I agree with Kurt that Putin has been running the show all along, but there was a pretty face up there, Medvedev, the president, was speaking in ways that made it easier for those who wanted to pretend that the Russian bear wasn't growling a little bit. So now that, unless Putin changes enormously in his demeanor, that will change. This can redound to the benefit of the Visegrad Four and the Central and Eastern Europeans in the sense that they have reason to be a little bit more concerned. Certainly Putin will try to undercut whatever the rest of Europe is trying to do in Ukraine, and Moldova, and Belarus, and Georgia, etc. With regard to the role of Germany, I agree again with Kurt that we're seeing more of the same in Germany. However, that means that to some extent, when Sarkozy goes to Berlin or Merkel goes to Paris to try to dominate the agenda or set the agenda for the EU, or for that matter, the European position within NATO, the German position isn't what it used to be. It isn't the de Gaulle position or even the Chirac position. And so there is need for a counterweight to the extent that we would like to see all of Europe become more strong, more energetically committed to a Western alliance and the transatlantic partnership around the world, not just in the alliance NATO context. To that extent, the absence of Germany as a major player on certain issues, or as a weak player on those issues, if you want to put it that way, means that the role of the Visegrad countries and the other Central Europeans, again, particularly if they speak with a single voice, can carry more weight within the EU and within the councils of NATO. Thank you.
Okay. Next batch of questions. We have about 10 minutes, so please.
Thank you. Clara O'Donnell, visiting fellow at Brookings. I've got a question for Robert Kron on Poland's efforts to develop EU defence cooperation as part of its presidency. I mean, what is your assessment of the US government's views on these efforts? And as part of this, in the UK, Liam Fox's team has been saying that Fox has convinced Panetta to oppose the idea of an operational headquarters. Do you know if this is true? And in your view, how much interest is there in Washington to get involved on this OHQ question?
Very specific. Let's go to Oleg.
My name is Oleg Kravchenko. I'm the chargé of Belarus. And I would like to disagree with what Mr. Kurt Volker had to say about the tougher approach on Eastern Partnership and Belarus. I do believe this is counterproductive and it would lead nowhere. Engagement would be the most, the wisest and the most effective approach in promoting change, which I understand you advocate. Think of this example. Belarus, together with Ukraine and Lithuania, has suggested 20 specific projects for the Eastern Partnership to be implemented and hasn't heard back since then. So to tell the truth, in our view, in view of a country participant of the Eastern Partnership, it is still a, very interesting political project. which has yet to come up with some specific proposals which would be of, again, specific interest to the countries. Although at the same time, we are interested in continuing the cooperation with the Eastern Partnership, and we will do so. But still, I think that engagement is much more effective than a tougher approach, which really I don't see how it can lead somewhere. Let me also disagree with what you had with your assessment of the December 2010 events in Belarus. The elections itself, if to read carefully the conclusions of the OSCE or DIHR, were, in my view, no better, but no much worse than the elections in other CIS countries, again, according to the ODIHR conclusions. But as it usually happens here while discussing what happened in Belarus, there is a very important but missing element, an attempt by a group of protesters to violently storm a government building. So I don't think that when a group of protesters started to smash and break windows and doors in the government building, still working, our law enforcement had much choice. And this is documented in a OSCE office spot report. So, and we see such reactions by the law enforcement in other countries also just recently and this morning in New York. So this is my comment rather than a question. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Oleg. Maybe one more question, then we'll go back to the panelists, particularly to Kurt. I think you can't wait for his answer, can you? Okay, Kurt?
I appreciate your aplomb in making your position clear, but it reminds me of the expression, you know, who you're going to believe, me or your own eyes. And when you see what has happened in Belarus in terms of Lukashenko's regime, in terms of the electoral climate, in terms of the media, in terms of opposition political figures, in terms of political prisoners, it seems to be the very little even to discuss there. The question of engagement, taking it from maybe a more thoughtful perspective than I originally put out, I do think that there are appropriate ways to engage. I think the university in Vilnius, for example, is a very good example of finding ways to engage with the population, with academics, to do it with some academic freedom. Certainly in terms of visitors, I think it's important to put limits on people with the regime or profiting with the regime so that they would be under visa restrictions. But for others in the country to be able to travel and have access to other countries in the EU, I think that's important. I think broadcasting and providing sources of information into Belarus is another important way of engaging with the population. But I also think that engaging with the government and the regime has proven that it removes the incentives of the regime to actually change. And when put under more pressure, you do see this demand coming from the regime. We want to be engaged more, and that is what gives the EU and others leverage to then set out the conditions for what has to change in Belarus.
Okay, Robert, the defense cooperation.
In regards to Poland's efforts on CSDP and the views of the U.S. government, well, I can't speak for the U.S. government because I'm not a part of the U.S. government, but as an analyst, I can say that, I mean, the U.S. has broadly always supported European defense coordination mechanisms and CSDP as a useful backdrop and a useful bolstering factor within NATO. And so in terms of Poland, this has always been Poland's view as well. And so as long as developments to make Europe more coherent, more capable, and more stable in the defense realm are something that just makes NATO more effective in general, then this is a move in the right direction. As far as the follow-up question, I have no comment.
Adrian, you want to say something? In response to these...
Also to this, yes.
Okay. Yeah. You're on.
Yes, I very much agree with Kurt's comments in response to the Belarus chargé. And I would add, we've talked about carrots. if you engagement is about offering carrots in large measure, if the carrots are all taken and eaten and there's no counterpart, no result, no change in democratic behavior or rule of law, then that's when you have to switch to a different policy and stop offering carrots. Now, but the comment that I wanted to make is the size of the carrot. We've talked earlier about the golden carrot of EU expansion not being available for a country like Ukraine or eventually Belarus. When there's not a golden carrot available, if you can put together a number of actual orange, natural carrots, real carrots, small, but a bundle of them. Have you ever had a horse and fed a horse one carrot at a time? That is often a very, very desirable strategy. Why do I say that? Because there's been so much emphasis on decreased resources, both in Europe and in the United States, for carrying out our foreign policy, whether it's democracy promotion, encouraging rule of law and human rights, or whether it is fighting wars in Afghanistan or reinforcing or redeploying to some extent some of our military assets where they're more needed. We have fewer, on both sides of the Atlantic, fewer resources, therefore pooling resources, therefore closer dialogue, therefore greater coordination is clearly desirable, and I'm glad to see that it's happening. And I agree with what Robert said about the recent cooperation.
Sure, please.
I just wanted to add one thing to Clara's question, which is the Washington attitude was sort of what you were asking about, and I think there the attitude is people have stopped believing that Europe's going to create any defense capabilities, so no one's going to worry about the structures. If you were going to create these structures and they would be competitive with NATO and duplicate the efforts that people are making, then people might raise a concern. But at this point, no one really takes it seriously.
Okay, do we want to end on that note? Or is there another question? Maybe one more question. We'll still have a couple of minutes. Nobody? Okay, all right, that's it. Thanks very much. I'd like to thank our panelists for a great job.